And welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Mary Cummings Jordan. Her name is synonymous with a massive effort to vaccinate Philadelphia's underserved communities against COVID-19. Dr. Ayla Stanford and the Black Doctors Consortium vaccinated tens of thousands of Philadelphians, and President Biden recently appointed her to be a regional director for the Department of Health and Human Services. Dr. Stanford will join us to talk about her new role and ongoing work for health equity. And later, a new exhibit at the Winter Tour Museum in Delaware takes us back to First Lady Jackie Kennedy's 1962 televised tour of the White House. We'll explore the important connection between Winter Tour and the White House. But we begin with the Pennsylvania primary. Tomorrow, Pennsylvania voters will head to the polls in one of the most watched primary contests in the country. Voters will choose the candidates who will vie for the retiring Pat Toomey's U.S. Senate seat. The outcome of that race in November could determine the balance of power in the U.S. Senate. Voters will also decide which Republican will run against State Attorney General Josh Shapiro for governor. Pennsylvania is a key swing state, and what happens here between now and November will have implications for the rest of the country. Joining us now to explain what's at stake and what voters need to know is Burwood Yost. He is the director of the Floyd Institute for Public Policy at the Center for Opinion Research at Franklin and Marshall College. Burwood Yost, welcome to the Regional Roundup.
Good morning, Tracy.
So the big watch, of course, as we mentioned, is the big race to watch is the U.S. Senate here in Pennsylvania, with Senator Pat Toomey retiring. His seat is up for grabs. Can you explain why this is such a critical race this year?
Well, I think as your listeners would know, the Senate is closely divided, currently controlled by the Democrats through Vice President Harris's vote. There are four basically toss-up Senate races by those who pay attention to these things across the United States: Nevada, Arizona, Pennsylvania, and Georgia. Pennsylvania is the only open seat of those four toss-up races, and it's the only Republican-held seat that the Democrats feel that they have a chance to win. And the Senate is, of course, vital given what we expect to happen in the House races. It's pretty common for the party of the president to lose seats during a midterm election. And I think many people who are watching think that the U.S. House is going to flip control. And so that makes these races for the Senate even more vital. Obviously, what might happen with the president's agenda is greatly affected by who controls these offices.
So let's talk about the candidates. On the Democratic side, we've got John Fetterman, who has been the front runner, suffered a stroke over the weekend. Let's talk about him and whether you think that the medical news will change the landscape for him at all.
Well, you know, that's an interesting question because, first, Fetterman has been pretty much in the lead since the beginning of this race, and he's only built his advantage since he really started advertising in earnest in January and February, and we've seen his lead grow. So he's really very well positioned to win this primary. Now, the unexpected news of his stroke is certainly something that we have to think about. But, you know, arguments about the health of the candidates wasn't anything that we had discussed prior to this. And so, you know, I think if this had been a candidate, an older candidate like a Bernie Sanders or a Joe Biden, and this had happened, I think that might raise some doubts in people's minds. But given the fact that this hasn't been an issue raised by any of the candidates, and that Mr. Fetterman seems to be in good health and recovering, I don't think this is going to make a big difference. In addition, you know, many people have already cast their ballot. As you know, in Pennsylvania, you can request a mail-in ballot. I think there are close to a million requested mail-in and absentee ballots. So I suspect that there's a good many votes that have been cast already.
Well, let's talk about a couple of the others just on the Democratic side. Of course, Fetterman being the front runner, but then there's Connor Lamb and Malcolm Kenyatta as well. Do either of them have a real shot against Fetterman at this point?
Look, you're always reluctant to rule anyone out because things are so changeable. And even if you think about the last week, how much has changed in these various races. So, you know, anything really can happen. Polling in primaries is notoriously shaky. And a big part of that is because voters don't really pay attention till the end. We're not sure what voter turnout will be, and that makes a big difference. That said, you know, Fetterman seems to be in a really good position. As I said, he's grown his advantage over the course of the last several months. He also seems to fit sort of the profile. If you think about what's happening on both sides, I think voters are looking for people who may be less establishment in their perspectives. And Conor Lamb is certainly an outstanding candidate. He's got a terrific resume. And in many normal years, you'd say he would be the person to beat. He's got a lot of support from his own party. But that just doesn't seem to be the resume voters are looking for this year. So, you know, I think that works to Fetterman's advantage.
Yeah. On the Republican side, of course, you've got Dr. Oz, who has spent millions of dollars of his own money on the race. He's also got Donald Trump's endorsement. And I wonder if you think that that endorsement and the money that he's put into this has been enough to get him front runner status, or do you think that Kathy Barnett is catching up?
Well, there's no doubt that we've seen a surge for Kathy Barnett. And, you know, that's... I think that movement has surprised a lot of people. I think in part it comes from the fact that it comes from two things. First, that Dr. Oz and David McCormick have spent a lot of money not just trying to elevate their own candidacies, but to try to tear their opponents down. And I think that has created some doubt in the minds of voters about whether those candidates are sufficiently conservative to represent them in a Republican primary. So I think that's a lot of what we're seeing. I do think that the Trump endorsement would help Dr. Oz, but Dr. Oz is not particularly popular among Republican voters. And I think that's what made the Trump endorsement of him so risky. In our polling and in other polls we've seen, Dr. Oz is viewed more unfavorably than favorably by Republican voters. And I think that kind of concern that they have about him and whether he's sufficiently conservative, maybe tamping down his numbers. He's still, from what we can tell, in the lead. But again, you've got Barnett, you've got Oz, you've got McCormick, all within a few points of each other. So really, it's hard to say what's going to happen tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, Pennsylvanians, of course, will also elect a new governor this year to succeed Governor Tom Wolf. We mentioned that Josh Shapiro, the current state attorney general, is running unopposed on the Democratic side. But in the fall, he would face one of eight Republican challengers. Who do you think Shapiro is most likely to find himself running against come November?
Well, I think that Doug Mastriano is the candidate to beat. You know, he had a consistent lead in some of the polling that I've seen, and that lead has only grown over the last week or so. Now we see him having a double-digit advantage in some of the polls that have come out recently. Plus, over the weekend, President Trump endorsed Mastriano. So, you know, he's clearly at this point, in my mind, the candidate to beat on the Republican side. But, you know, again, we'll see. As I said, the polls can be variable. There's still a lot going on. I think there's been some efforts among the Republican Party leadership, kind of the mainstream, to consolidate and perhaps get some support behind Lou Barletta. We saw Jake Corman, Melissa Hart drop out of the race and try to encourage their supporters to support him. But I still think that's too little, too late. And Mastriano is definitely the guy to beat. He's got strong grassroots support from across the state.
Burwood, the survey that you have done measures many different things as it relates to the election. I'm wondering what you found out about the general mood of Pennsylvania voters on this eve of the election, and what are voters most concerned about?
Well, the mood is sour. There's no doubt about it. When we look at the issues that are facing the state and the things that are concerning voters right now, it's primarily economic in nature, at least in this state. People are concerned about inflation. They're not happy about the economy and the way things are so expensive these days. It's kind of hard to avoid the rising gas and food prices. And they're really, I think, holding the Democrats and President Biden responsible for that. You know, they're also dissatisfied, I have to say, with our political climate. Lots of people would like to see things get done, and many voters tell us they're just not happy with the performance of our politicians these days. And so, you know, I think that is driving a lot of the sentiment the voters have, and it leads many of them to say, hey, look, the things in the U.S., things in Pennsylvania are not going the way they should. And I think in part, that may be why we're seeing these anti-establishment candidates being so successful in these races.
How do you think that translates to turnout? Do you think that we'll see strong turnout, or will people just decide to take a pass?
Well, you know, that's a fair question. I think it depends on what we're comparing to. If you look back to 2000, turnout in a primary election is usually in the upper 20% in even-numbered years, so 28% for Republicans, 29% for Democrats turned out since the year 2000 in these kinds of races. I do think we'll get much higher turnout than that. I think we'll probably see turnout above 40% for these primaries, simply because of the amount of spending and the amount of media coverage. So these races have been in front of people more pronounced ways than in previous elections. As you said at the top of the show, I mean, it is rare to have an open gubernatorial and Senate seat in this state. Hasn't happened since 1958. So I think the combination of the many candidates, the high volume of advertising and spending, all the media coverage of these races is going to put turnout above what you would normally expect in a primary. But again, you know, it'll be below what we would normally see in a general election.
Got about a minute to go before we have to say goodbye. But of course, everyone has been talking about this leaked draft of the Supreme Court opinion on Roe v. Wade. There's a lot of concern that Roe v. Wade is going to become a thing of the past. Do you think that that is a factor at all in this election, or is it more of a concern for November?
We don't see it as a factor in this election. I mean, let's face it, on both sides, there isn't much difference in the candidate's perspective if you're choosing among the Democrats or the Republicans. So, and when we ask why people are supporting candidates for those offices, the number of people who select something like abortion is very small. I think it was 2% of Democrats and 4% of Republicans in the primaries. So it's not going to really factor into these primary elections, but it is certainly going to play a significant role, I think, in the fall elections, in part depending on how things go with the economy.
Well, at that point, we must leave it there and say goodbye. Burwood Yost, thank you so much for being with us. Burwood Yost is the director of the Floyd Institute for Public Policy at the Center for Opinion Research at Franklin and Marshall College. Up next, Dr. Ayla Stanford joins us to talk about her new role in the Department of Health and Human Services.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Mary Cummings Jordan. She gained national recognition for her efforts to vaccinate underserved communities against COVID-19. Dr. Ayla Stanford formed the Black Doctors COVID-19 Consortium, which traveled around the region providing tests and vaccines to those who often had the least access. Dr. Stanford's work caught the attention of President Biden, who recently appointed her to be a regional director for the Department of Health and Human Services. Her area of responsibility spans 5 states, including Pennsylvania and Delaware, plus the District of Columbia. Dr. Ayla Stanford joins us here in the studio to talk about her new position and the ongoing work of promoting health equity. Dr. Stanford, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, congratulations, first of all, on your appointment to be Director of Region 3 of the Department of Health and Human Services. Before we talk about your new role, I want to talk a little bit about what you are most known for, which is being the founder and the face of the Black Doctors Consortium in Philadelphia. How many people have you and your team tested and vaccinated since you began?
So we have touched over 100,000 in the region, and that's been urban areas, it's been suburban communities, and largely because of the trust that we built and because the people gave us the privilege to serve them. And that early work back where people were devoid of resources to get testing and to get contact tracing, building that trust early on helped save lives when it came time for the vaccine, because those same communities said, Dr. Stanford, when you say it's okay to get the vaccine, we're coming. Yeah. And so it just echoes how important trust between your healthcare provider and the patient is to having the best health outcome.
That is such an important point, because we know that there has been a long history of mistrust in the African American community toward the medical profession. Talk a little bit more about that and how you go about building that trust.
So I think this is fantastic, but I think the biggest thing is that we have to change the narrative that the healthcare system has been untrustworthy. It's not that African Americans and people of color one day said, I'm not going to trust my doctor. It's because procedures were performed on women without anesthesia, without their consent, to perfect it before it was done on white women. And some of our local prisons, that procedures were done without the consent of the prisoners. And then with COVID, that so many of the resources were not allocated to the communities that were hurting the most. And so I think as healthcare providers and even administrators, we have to recognize the history from which the person you want to help is coming from, and be empathetic and have cultural humility as you care for that individual.
Yeah. Well, all the work that you've done, as we pointed out, garnered national attention. Last month, President Biden appointed you to lead Region 3 for the Health and Human Services offices. Tell us about your new role, what it entails, and what your priorities are now.
Well, my role, primarily, I am a information seeker for Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, the District, Virginia, and West Virginia. So in those areas that are focused on COVID response, recovery and treatment, maternal health, the opioid crisis and epidemic, mental wellness, and just health equity, and that intersectability of health equity in all of those different fields. And so in those five states in the District of Columbia, to say, how are things working for maternal health here? What are your rates? Do you have the resources you need to help combat the skyrocketing rates that may be in West Virginia? And then in Baltimore, it may be something different with the opioid crisis, and recognizing that each state and the district may need a different approach to focus on those priorities, which again, COVID, maternal health, opioid, health equity, and mental wellness, especially in our adolescents.
Speaking of mental wellness, in addition to the million lives that COVID has taken from us, it also left in its wake an exacerbated mental health crisis. Can you talk a little bit more about that and how that needs to be addressed as we try to work our way through the pandemic? You know, we're left with the mental health crisis.
Right. So there are several initiatives coming from Secretary Becerra and from the Biden-Harris administration. One of them that you can actually get some information about now is the 988 line, which is going to take place of the National Suicide Hotline, which is a way that people can quickly reach out when they need someone to talk to. And how it's been exacerbated is children who no longer have parents because of COVID, parents who have lost their jobs or lost their homes because of COVID, and then also the isolation that so many people have felt, that have increase the loneliness, the despondent, sometimes the suicide, and actually the rage that has fueled so many of the homicides, not just in Philadelphia, but around the nation. And so recognizing that our children, primarily, we really saw an increase in anxiety and ER visits and hospitalizations of our youth. And so in the coming, I'll say, less than a month, you'll be seeing and learning more about that from Health and Human Services and what we're doing to help combat that.
Yeah. Last fall, the Ayla Stanford Center for Health Equity opened in North Philadelphia. Talk about how that expands on the work that you had already been doing to fight COVID.
So the beautiful thing and what I learned most from the work over the 2 years and what I bring into this position is that you have to be proximal to the people that you want to serve for them to have the best health outcomes. So that means knowing what their needs are, knowing what their challenges are, knowing what brings them joy. And so when you put a Center for Health Equity in a community where the life expectancy is the lowest of anywhere else in the city of Philadelphia, and you say, we care about your well-being, so you don't have to travel many miles, but you can walk outside of your home and get the care, expert care. The center is across the street from a high school. It's adjacent to a strip mall, also for low-income housing, and it's along a bus route, so it's very accessible. And how that helps me in the current role is recognizing we have to be close to those community-based organizations and the people who are experiencing what you want to improve. And what I mean by that is not assuming you know what they need, but making sure you ask them what they need.
What is the life expectancy in that community? I'm just curious.
Yeah, so it's about 65 to 67, but if you go 3 miles away, it can go up to 77 to 85.
Wow. Yeah. It's important. You know, I'm curious, this year, your alma mater, Penn State Hershey, admitted a record number of students of color to the medical program. And I wonder if you think that that's part of a trend. And can you talk about the need for greater representation among healthcare providers?
Yes. So certainly representation matters. That's sort of a hashtag that you hear a lot. But we also know from the Institutes of Medicine and the Unequal Treatment Report that came out that there are better health outcomes wherein you have physicians that reflect the population that they serve. Now, African Americans represent 13 to 14% of the population and only 4% of practicing physicians. And so there's a big gap there. And so, yes, it helps to have more doctors in the pipeline, but honestly, that takes years. And so what we have to do now is make sure that the people who are delivering the care are coming from a place of empathy, coming from a place of, I don't understand everything about you, but I need you to teach me so I can care for you, to be patient, to try to put yourself in their shoes, and to do your best to undo the subjective narrative with objective data. And what I mean by that is not assuming people are missing an appointment because they don't want to come. Maybe it's because they couldn't get off work at the time that your appointment was available, and really asking the next question so we can get to the best health outcomes.
Yeah, you're looking for the barriers that might keep people from treatment.
That is correct.
And from compliance, for that matter.
Right. And so your question, yes, I think that having more folks in the pipeline absolutely is part of the solution, but it's only one part of the solution. We've also got to educate the folks who are on the ground every day.
And Dr. Stanford, you've been doing exactly what you have described. You've been working one-on-one in a patient-centered environment for a long time. And I'm just wondering what the adjustment has been like for you as you've kind of shifted into more of a policy-making role and perhaps less in the role of the one-on-one patient-doctor relationship.
So fortunately, this month actually makes 25 years that I've been a physician, and the majority of my career has been that. So I have so many experiences to draw on, but honestly, it's the staff in my office that are guiding me. And I'll just give a shout out to Region 3 office staff, because they have been there long before me, and many will be there long after me. So they are really guiding me. But every time we meet somewhere and I meet with the administrators and the CEO, I always make a point now to meet with the caregivers, the people providing the care, because I can't lose touch of that. It allows me to advocate better for the people we're serving when I know the challenges that the patients are having and the people providing the care for the patients are also experiencing.
Yeah. Let me take a moment and invite our listeners to join us. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, or of course you can always call us at 888-477-9499 as we talk with Dr. Ayla Stanford. Of course, as you well know, the Biden administration has been requesting more funding for COVID of late, anticipating another surge coming down the road. Congress, however, does not seem to have much of an appetite for that, at least at the moment. And I wonder what you think the implications would be for a lack of funding or greatly reduced funding as we head into the fall, the winter, we go back inside, the weather gets colder. What are the implications of that?
So the implications could be catastrophic, but they don't have to be. If anyone knows how to do a lot with a little, I certainly do, and hope to spread some of that innovation across our region. And we can't put all our eggs in one basket. We need to have a plan A, which of course would be for things to be passed and for us to have the funding, but we need a plan B, C, and D as well. We know which communities will be most impacted, and with what resources we have, that's where the emphasis should go. And so it's a challenge, reminding everyone to vote tomorrow, right? That's how we make a lot of the differences, but we just have to have a backup plan. And just sharing with Congress that we don't want to be reactionary all the time. Sometimes it's good to have preventative measures in place so you don't have such huge impacts and devastation on communities. And everyone likes to throw the money when things are bad, realizing they would save a lot more if they put it there in the beginning to prevent some of the outcomes we don't need.
How concerned are you about COVID right now, as it seems that we're hearing about a lot of cases? All of a sudden, everybody knows somebody who's got COVID. And this is the summertime when the weather is getting warmer, at least springtime. Weather's warmer, we're outside. Fall's coming, winter's coming. What do you anticipate happening?
So I can say I'm always concerned about COVID. But what I do know now is that even as we start to see the cases go up slightly, we're not seeing the hospitalizations go up. We're not seeing the deaths go up and continue. It's sort of a ebb and flow. And it lets us know that the treatment modalities that are out there are working, that the vaccinations and the boosters, this is an opportunity to say, if you haven't gotten booster one and two, please get it. We still know that the children have a low vaccination rates, and the vaccines are available and free and accessible. So please get the kids vaccinated before they start going to summer camp and they get out of school. And so I am concerned, but still, May of 2022 is way better than May of 2021 and much better than May of 2020. So I remain hopeful. Make sure you're getting your information from a trusted resource for information. And again, the vaccines are available, as are the boosters and the treatment modalities. And reach out to your doc or to HHS or to the health department for more information.
You mentioned getting the two boosters, and a lot of people now are talking about when should they get it, trying to sort of game it out, what's the right time for it. What advice do you have for people who are a little bit confused about booster number two?
So I would definitely say if you are high risk, 65 and up, 50 with a chronic health condition that puts you at risk for severe COVID if you contract it, if you're immunosuppressed, if you are a cancer patient, if you are on chronic steroids, if you have an autoimmune disease, you are high risk. And I would not hesitate at all to get that booster. Certainly, if you're someone who's working in the house and you rarely interact with the public, I could see you wanting to wait it out so you can prolong your immunity. But if you are age 5 to 105 at this point, you should have at least gotten 2 and likely 12 and up, the booster. I don't want to confuse that with anyone.
Yeah. I want to go back to the Center for Health Equity on Ayla Stanford Way, I might point out. Do you view that as potentially a national model for health equity, for all of the things that you talked about in terms of understanding patients, understanding their needs, their barriers, and just promoting health equity across the country?
I do. I do believe that people having expert care in proximity to where they live matters. So often the people who will staff those facilities are people of the community or people who are very comfortable in that space. And everyone is not, and that is okay. We also need folks miles away at the tertiary care hospitals. But certainly having something where you can get to the doctor before you go to work, or they're open when you come home from work, that they're open on weekends, that a school can bring its student body over and vice versa. It's so beneficial. And that works in rural communities, too, who had challenges getting to cities to get their care. And so I do believe, and I hope that that's one of the reasons why President Biden asked me to serve in this role.
Yeah. So in our last minute or so here, Dr. Stanford, you have had an incredible year. I mean, the opening of the primary care clinic that bears your name, a portion of a street named after you. You were named a CNN hero. Good Morning America surprised you with a tribute. Of course, there was the appointment from President Biden that we've talked about. You even got a shout out from Patti LaBelle, for heaven's sakes. I mean, what has it been like for you this last year?
Surreal. It's been surreal. Sometimes I have to pinch myself, but I remind myself that if it wasn't for the people of Philadelphia that gave us the privilege to take care of them, that allowed us the opportunity to come into their lives and care for them, and then we developed a trust relationship, there would be no story to tell. And so it always brings me back to the patient, to being humbled, to being, it's a privilege for someone to allow you to care for them. And now I just get to do it on a national level. And I'm excited and prepared for the challenge.
Yeah, well, we are excited for you. Dr. Ayla Stanford, thank you so much for making time to be with us on the Regional Roundup.
Thank you for having me.
Stick around because we've got more to come, including that historic White House tour and the connection between the White House and Winterthur Museum in Delaware. You might be surprised.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Mary Cummings Jordan. It was the most watched television program of its time, and it was not the Super Bowl. In 1962, First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy invited the nation into a newly redesigned White House through a televised tour. 80 million people tuned in, and when it was over, the country had a new appreciation for the First Lady and a renewed pride in the Executive Mansion. 60 years later, a new generation of Americans can experience the tour in a different way. It's the subject of a new exhibit at Delaware's Winterthur Museum, which played a key role in the original renovation decades ago. Joining us with more on the original tour and the new exhibit is Elaine Rice Bachman. She is the Maryland State Archivist and guest curator of Jacqueline Kennedy and H.F. DuPont, From Winterthur to the White House. She is also the co-author, along with Archer Abbott, of Designing Camelot, The Kennedy White House Restoration and Its Legacy. Elaine Rice Bachman, welcome to the Regional Roundup.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So how did the idea come about to create an exhibit that showcased Mrs. Kennedy's famous redesign of the White House in 62?
Well, it's really an exhibition that is based on my thesis work in the Winterthur program of 30 years ago, which was about Mr. DuPont's connection to the White House. But, of course, it also comes 60 years after the televised tour and 60 years after the founding of the White House Historical Association, which was also Mrs. Kennedy's doing. And it was the White House Historical Association that allowed us to do a new edition of the book Designing Camelot with my co-author James Archer Abbott. So the timing was such that it was a good time to look back on this historic period. And, of course, the connection to Winterthur was something that they were happy to bring back to the American public, because it's not something that's very well known.
Yeah. So we mentioned early on that the original broadcast was watched by 80 million people. Can you talk about why that was such a landmark event in television history?
Well, it was an unusual program for its day. I mean, aside from the fact that this was the First Lady leading a tour of the White House, it was a very intimate program, just in the way it was produced. I looked around at the television schedules in 1962. Some of the shows that were on right then were Leave It to Beaver, The Flintstones, The Jetsons, Mr. Ed, Lassie. These, you know, very highly produced comedic shows, and then very hard-hitting news shows like CBS Reports. So here was something really different. You know, the technology of the day, television's, you know, burgeoning technological advances allowed her to sort of have a hidden microphone. There were antennas hidden behind the curtains throughout the room. So viewers really felt like they were walking through the White House with Mrs. Kennedy. And the fact that it was shown on all three networks over the course of 3 or 4 days allowed for the public to really gain this momentum of hearing about it and then encouraging others to watch it, so that ultimately 80 million people watched it. And it was also syndicated in 50 countries.
How do you think the telecast impacted Americans' perceptions of the First Lady?
Well, I think that's an excellent question, because now we look back and we always imagine her as always enormously popular because she's become such an icon of the 20th century. But that wasn't true. When she first moved into the White House, there was a lot of sort of suspicion about this very young First Lady, a debutante, had this, you know, this finishing school voice, came from a very wealthy family, was a part of a very wealthy family. So she was not universally loved as we sort of think of her now. With this tour, she was able to really connect with people across the country in a very direct way. And she was sharing such interesting information about American history. She was really explaining that her whole project was on behalf of the American people to make this house the people's house, something that everyone could be proud of. And it deeply impacted tourism to the house. Visitation to the White House tripled in the first year of the Kennedy administration and only kept going through 1963.
In your book, Designing Camelot, you tell us that when the Kennedys arrived at the White House, Mrs. Kennedy was rather, shall we say, underwhelmed with the furnishings. In fact, we have a little bit of sound here that we want to play from that original telecast, and I'd like for you to comment on it afterwards. Here it is.
It just seemed to me such a shame when we came here to find hardly anything of the past in the house, hardly anything before 1902. I know when we went to Columbia, the presidential palace there has all the history of that country in it, where Simon Bolivar was, every piece of furniture in it has some link with the past. I thought the White House should be like that.
So it was clear that she felt that there was just not enough of a sense of history in the White House that you might see in other countries.
That's right. That's such a brilliant quote. She always said that she was disappointed by a visit to the White House she made as a tourist with her mother and sister when she was 11 years old. That would have been during the Roosevelt administration. And she felt like she had just been shuffled through. She said that the National Gallery in Mount Vernon had made a far greater impression on her than the White House. So then when her husband was going to become president, she knew, based on that early experience, that this was something she wanted to focus on. And exactly, by visiting other countries, by spending the year abroad that she did in Paris at the Sorbonne, she had really seen so many wonderful residences. She of course had grown up in very fine houses, but she really had a sense that the presidency needed a backdrop that was befitting the dignity of the office and the long history of the United States. Mm-hmm. And being so young as they were, although they weren't the youngest first lady and president in history, they were among the youngest, and they wanted to project this sense of connection to a grand historical past. And she did that by incorporating historical things into the rooms.
Her main collaborator on the project, of course, was Henry Francis DuPont, who turned his enormous home into what we now know as the Winterthur Museum. Can you tell us a bit about him and why this was such a strategic partnership for both of them?
That's right. Mrs. Kennedy was so smart. She certainly wasn't the first lady who was going to try to bring antiques into the White House. But she knew she needed a real foundation and a path forward that would have longevity. And she was early on advised that she should set up a fine arts committee. And she looked to Henry Francis DuPont as the chairman of that committee because at the time he was nearly 80 years old. But Winterthur had been a museum for nearly 10 years, the first museum of American decorative arts in the country. And he was the premier collector of American antiquities. So by ensuring his participation in the project, he was also an avowed Republican, which also helped her show that it was a bipartisan project. She was really associating herself with the premier collector, a man who, although he had been collecting all his life, it was in his later life that he really began styling himself as a scholar, someone who was basing his choices on historical documentation. That's exactly the kind of authenticity, the kind of gravitas she needed. And of course, between them, although they had not met before, they were in the same social circles, they drew upon their friendships and connections to create a fine arts committee and an advisory committee that ensured that there were donors, there were people who had enough money to donate to the project, people who were collectors themselves, who were knowledgeable, and then museum curators who could also advise on the historical accuracy. So it was strategic. He did jump into this, you know, wholeheartedly for a man who was elderly at the time and really set about laying a groundwork for her.
How did they get along?
They got along very well. You know, she was, of course, very deferential to him. He was five decades older than her, of her mother's generation, and even beyond that. She invited him to all of the state events at the White House during the time. She allowed him to come to the White House very frequently with his curators from Winterthur to advise on things. They wrote each other hundreds of letters because she really was navigating the personalities, not only of DuPont and the curators at Winterthur, but also the decorators who were on the project, worked very closely with Sister Parrish, Mrs. Henry Parrish II, and also the French decorator Stéphane Boudin of the Janssen Company, who was also very involved, although that was not publicly known, him being a French decorator. They very much emphasized the American role in the project, American advisors, American textile manufacturers, although in the book, James Abbott is an expert on the French side of the story. We really tell the complete picture that maybe was less put out to the public at the time.
The renovation cost something like $2 million to complete, and you mentioned donors. Was it all paid for by donors, or how did that get paid for?
It was all paid for. It was non-taxpayer money, let's put it that way. She had spent the $50,000 allowed each administration within 2 weeks of moving into the White House, just renovating the family rooms, which, of course, was necessary. She was bringing a young family into the house, and Sister Parrish helped her do that. So she knew she could not be seen as a first lady who was coming in and spending government money on the White House. So she really sought the donations of these members of the advisory committee. She sought donations from dealers and auction houses. She sought people who could underwrite the purchases, but she knew she needed to have a revenue stream. And that is why she pushed from the very beginning to create a guidebook that could be sold to visitors to the White House to fund this project. And that was something that was not popular among President Kennedy's advisors. They feared it would commercialize the White House or be seen as tacky to be selling things at the White House. But she stuck to it. And in 1962, the first guidebook was published. They printed initially something like 600,000 copies, sold for a dollar, and it was sold out within a matter of months. That guidebook is still created today. It's in something like its 26th edition. And that became the revenue stream for her project, as well as the reason the White House Historical Association, the nonprofit which published the book, came into existence. And that, of course, today is in its 60th year.
You're right that when word got out about the project, that people just started donating all kinds of things, many of which did not pass the Jackie Kennedy sniff test. Can you talk about that a little bit?
That's right. There's wonderful letters from all over the country, particularly after the tour, because people became so enamored of her project, writing to Mr. DuPont at the Winterthur Post Office, talking about grandmother's chair or table. And most of the time, he just wrote back and said, you know, no, thank you. But occasionally, he would say, your letter is being sent on to Mrs. Kennedy for her consideration. Now, truly, very few things came in that way, but a few very wonderful things did. Catherine Bolin of Villanova, Pennsylvania, had a Bélanger chair in her collection. That's one of the original French-made suite of furnishings purchased by President Monroe for the White House that had been alienated from the house over time. And it was that unsolicited gift of her chair that inspired a lot of the other donations to the White House as well.
Yeah. You also write about some of the rather blunt descriptions that she gave of some of the areas of the White House that she didn't particularly care for.
She did. She was very, of course, diplomatic in all her letters, which were written. But in some of her more private moments and letters, she shared her opinions about the White House. She described the lower level floor as being a cross between a dentist office bomb shelter. And that's really because, you know, she was moving into a house that did not have a lot of historical significant furnishings because there had never been any protection for them. So over time, as different renovations occurred, redecorations, the old furniture was simply auctioned off or given away. If it became in disrepair, it was thrown out or sent into a storeroom. So there just had never been any idea of sort of preserving the collection. So what was in the White House, you know, might have looked like perfectly adequate furniture, but a lot of times it was department store reproductions of antique furniture. And it was really not until Mrs. Kennedy hired the first curator that they could go through the house, discover what was historically significant, restore that, bring it back into historical context. And then, of course, they brought in nearly 500 acquisitions of all sorts of furnishings and works of art to really bring a historical integrity to the rooms.
Mm. Elaine, the Kennedys were perhaps the closest thing to royalty that we have had in the United States, but you write that they were also experts in image making, in creating an aspirational identity that lasted long after the tragic end of the Kennedy presidency. Can you unpack that idea a little bit?
Absolutely. I mean, President Kennedy particularly had grown up in a family that very much manipulated the media for their promotion. And it is understood that it was President Kennedy who really encouraged Jacqueline Kennedy to do this televised tour. She herself was not very keen on any sort of press, but she knew that in order to sort of sell this project to the American people, that it would be beneficial for her to do that. So, you know, she definitely realized what she was doing in this tour was relating to people across the country in a way that you couldn't do necessarily just in a magazine article, and certainly not from the many articles that were written about her, but not with her own narrative. And I often do think, you know, is the reason that we care so much about this period of time, is the reason that we think so highly of what she did in the White House because of the tragic end? You know, is that why it is sealed in everyone's memory? And I think that's definitely part of it. But when you just go back and look at the program itself and the period of time and the reactions to it during their own time in the White House, I think you can understand that there really was a historical importance to this, an appreciation for it that transcends sort of the nostalgia we feel for the Kennedys today.
Mm. And Elaine, for people who are listening, maybe we're not aware of this exhibit at Winterthur, can you give us a sneak peek, give us a sense of what visitors will see when they come to the exhibit?
Yes, I mean, it really draws upon the Winterthur archives, which were my sources when I wrote my thesis. It really draws on the hundreds of letters and documentation that are there. So while grounding it in that really cultural moment of the historical tour where we have on loan from the John F. Kennedy Library the reproduction suit, the classic red suit that she wore during the tour, we have around that sort of the narrative story of why Winterthur was looked at as a model for Mrs. Kennedy, some wonderful new photos that were discovered in the archives of her visit to Winterthur, and then we walk through sort of three iconic rooms in the White House, the Green Room, the Red Room, and the Blue Room, and using furnishings from Winterthur as well well as wonderful loans of archival fabric from the Scala Mondre company. We sort of put together how these rooms came to be enhanced by the Kennedys, what objects were brought in, what were the different voices Mrs. Kennedy was listening to in creating these rooms, and we sort of take people through that process, as well as looking at the private rooms with some wonderful loans, again from the Kennedy Library, of Sister Parish's design boards. And we also have some wonderful loans from museums of furnishings that they actually loaned to Mrs. Kennedy's White House that they've now loaned to us. Mm. So it's really just a taste of that period of time and discussing what is its legacy and why was Winterthur a model for what was done there.
The exhibit is called Jacqueline Kennedy and H.F. DuPont from Winterthur to the White House. It runs from May 7th through January 8th. Elaine Rice Bachman, thank you so much for being with us on the Regional Roundup.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Our producers are Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. Our engineer today was Diana Martinez. And I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Mary Cummings Jordan. You have been listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY.